This week on the Northwest Politicast.
Republicans say this has been one of the most bipartisan sessions in Olympia in some time.
I would say this is the most cooperative year that I've seen in 13 years.
And Democrats agree.
I think we're getting a lot of bipartisan things done this year for sure. I think a big contributor to that is the fact that we're having an in-person session for the first time in 3 years.
Plus, amidst uncertainty about the nation's banks, the Treasury Secretary heads to Capitol Hill.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them.
And more frustration for teenagers as TikTok's future remains in doubt.
Now, reporting from Seattle, Jeff Pogula.
The legislative session continues down in Olympia. Some of the deadlines have already passed, and as a result, some bills wanted by both Republicans and Democrats have failed. However, others are still moving forward. There's still several weeks left in the legislative session, and lawmakers still have to craft a final budget. With an update from the Republican side, we're joined now by Representative J.T. Wilcox. He is the Republican leader in the State House of Representatives. And first off, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
The first question I have is about that budget. The negotiations obviously continue. Democrats control both chambers of the legislature. So where do those negotiations stand right now?
Well, you really have to ask Democrats about that. I think over in the Senate, there's a little more collaboration, but yeah, the tradition in the House is that Republicans don't know much, if anything, about the budget until it actually rolls out. And then we find out about the same time that you do, maybe a little bit of advance notice. So I can't really tell you much about a negotiation because there's not one.
I know a lot of the Democrats will be pushing for some of Jay Inslee's proposals. He announced his proposed budget back in December. Pretty hefty budget, a lot of spending in it and some new taxes. I would imagine Republicans are going to be overwhelmingly opposed to those ideas.
Yeah, I don't think it'll surprise anyone to find out that we're fiscally conservative. I think a little more fiscally conservative than they are in Washington, D.C., and state of Washington has seen a plethora of new taxes over the last few years. We have experienced record budget growth, and, you know, it's bedrock conservative convictions that we should live within our means, and we're going to continue to propose that. And under today's circumstances, where actually inflation increases state revenues, tax collections, it's not really that hard for the state to live within its means.
But haven't some of the economic forecasts predicted less taxable income coming into the state over the next couple of years? Don't you guys have to plan for that as well?
Well, we absolutely believe that we should. That's why we've always supported keeping the rainy day funds in the rainy day fund until we actually have a rainy day. And I think it's quite likely that those are coming in the future. And there are a few places where tax revenues are likely to be down because taxes have been increased so sharply in the area of real estate excise taxes, for example. Real estate transactions are way down, and so is the value of real estate transactions. So that's something that people have to be aware of. Another reason to be fiscally careful, I think. And, you know, this is probably a time when, as we stand up and talk about that, there's going to be a few Democrats that acknowledge that they have the same concern. And I hope that in the end that will make an impact on the way that they budget. And I have been told by my colleagues over in the Senate that the Senate Democrats are talking about caution a little more than the House Democrats.
Moving on from the budget, another one of the biggest issues that the Democrats and Republicans were fighting over this past session has been over police chases and the powers of police. Where do things stand there?
Well, I think that they are, you know, sort of balanced on the precipice right now. 2 years ago, an experiment was tried, which was we are going to make it very difficult for the police to give chase. We've been living for 2 years under those experimental conditions, and I think most people that are reasonable think that it's a failed experiment, and there's been Democrats that have said that too. In fact, there was a bill that was prime sponsored by a Democrat. It had 20 Democratic co-sponsors in the House, and despite that, it was not advanced for a vote on the floor, and that bill would have taken some small steps towards allowing the police a little more discretion in their ability to give chase. Now, at the last moment, the Senate brought an even more modest bill out. It's over here in the House now and still alive. And I think it's absolutely critical that that bill be advanced and we give our police, again, a little more discretion. This doesn't make anybody give chase, and local police departments can have a more restrictive policy if it's right for their neighborhoods and their communities, but it also allows them to make their own choices rather than the state deciding for everybody.
A number of other bills that Republicans had proposed and wanted to push through, some with big, broad bipartisan support, also failed at the deadlines to clear out of committee and out of House of Origin. What are some of the bills that you wanted to see passed that really didn't make it?
Well, here's another bill that actually is a Democratic bill, but Republicans feel strongly about it. And that is the overdue fix for the Blake decision. A court case a few years ago made all of our laws that make it illegal to possess the most dangerous drugs like fentanyl. And we had to pass a fix a couple of years ago to continue some level of policing. It wasn't a very good fix. It really said that when people are found in possession of those drugs, they can be asked to seek counseling. All Republicans and many Democrats believe that there should be some level of law enforcement and the judicial system. It's not the first choice when it comes to helping people with addiction, but it should be one of the choices that are available. And to do that, we would need to say that possession of fentanyl, for example, should at least be a gross misdemeanor. And that bill passed the Senate. It faces, I think, a difficult path in the House. And I think most reasonable people in the state of Washington would say that we should advance that bill and pass it and provide, again, some more options and some more choices for people that are dealing with that addiction.
So what happens if that bill doesn't pass? Does possession of drugs still remain legal in Washington State? Because there was that temporary fix that lawmakers passed.
Yeah, that has a definite expiration date. I think it was designed to create some motion this year, but there just seems to be these fairly narrowly focused groups in both Democratic caucuses that feel that we just cannot involve law enforcement in some of these things that are so important to public safety. I believe that's wrong. I think a lot of Democrats agree with Republicans on this, but it's been very difficult to actually move these things onto the floor.
It sounds like the negotiations and the work that's done between the two parties is a little tense at the moment, by the way you're speaking.
Well, on these issues, it is tense. You know, in many other ways, I would say this is the most cooperative year that I've seen in 13 years. In the House Ag Committee, for example, Ag and Natural Resources, the chair, Representative Mike Chapman, a Democrat, said that he was not going to advance any bills that were partisan. And he stuck to that. And most of the bills that came out of that committee were unanimous or very nearly unanimous with Republicans and Democrats. And he and members of his committee have been in my office many times this session hashing out differences that, you know, affect the ag and natural resource world. And as you can imagine, I'm pretty interested in that, too. And that's just an example of how well we can work together. And then in the world of housing, probably the three most difficult bills came out with strong bipartisan votes, not unanimous in any caucus, which I think is actually a sign that it's good legislation from the middle. And so we have the capability of doing that, and we've done it more than I've seen, again, in 13 years, but we still do have some stressful points, too.
Obviously, police reform, as we've talked about, what are some of the other stress points?
Well, the budget, you know, is always high stress, and I think there are a number of tax proposals that you're going to see Republicans object to. And I would say then two other areas have been difficult. First of all, we saw a bill go through the House on a strictly partisan, well, actually, it wasn't a strictly partisan vote. The yes vote was all Democrat. The no vote was Republicans and Democrats. And what it did is took away most of the sentence enhancements for things like crimes committed with firearms, crimes committed in school zones, crimes committed against people that are especially vulnerable. It didn't make sense to us to propose or pass that bill, and a few Democrats agreed with us. And then we've had some bills that deal with, I think, a really breakneck pace of decarbonization. I told the governor earlier this year that we're not trying to get in the way of that. The private sector has decided they're moving towards electrification at a rapid rate, and we should let that happen at the rate that is most efficient. But when we've seen bills that say we are going to totally end any new hookups to natural gas, regardless of whether or not there is electrical capacity or whether it fits the application, then we're voting no on those things too. But not because we're against electrification. We just want it to be done at the most sensible possible rate.
So as we kind of wrap up here, how would you gauge the legislative session as it's going this time around? You said it's a lot more cooperation than you've seen in more than a decade.
Well, I think the process is pretty good this year. Again, I think I've seen some committee chairs be far more independent of their caucuses than I've seen them in the past. And you and I have talked enough that, you know, I don't believe in single party government. And when you have chairs saying, I'm going to bring out bipartisan bills, that's a pretty good sign. At the same time, you know, I think that in certain areas, ideology is still way more important to some people and sometimes the majority than just common sense problem solving.
All right, Representative J.T. Wilcox, Republican leader in the State House of Representatives, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Still to come.
We heard from Republicans, so we'll get a Democratic take on the legislative session.
When the Northwest Politicast returns in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogelub. Now, last segment, we spoke with Representative J.T. Wilcox, the House Republican leader down in Olympia. Now, for a Democratic perspective, we're talking with Representative Joe Fitzgibbon. He is the Democratic leader in the House. And I want to start with kind of the last thing that Representative Wilcox had to say, and that was that he said this is one of the most bipartisan years he's seen overall in his 13 years in the state legislature, obviously aside from things like the budget, police issues, and things like that. But there seems to be a lot more cooperation this time around, according to him. Do you agree with that?
I think we're getting a lot of bipartisan things done this year, for sure. I think a big contributor to that is the fact that we're having an in-person session for the first time in 3 years, and it really is helpful to our collaboration across party lines to be able to work with each other face-to-face. And a lot of our big successes so far have been bipartisan around addressing the housing shortage, addressing workforce shortages. You know, there are some issues that we know we're going to disagree with our Republican colleagues on, like gun violence prevention and reproductive rights. But I agree with Representative Wilcox that there have been some great bipartisan wins so far this session. And I hope every single year that we're in session, the vast majority of the bills that we pass into law are bipartisan. But a lot of the attention tends to focus on the ones that do divide us more along party lines. And I'm happy that that's so far less true this year.
What do you think is different other than the fact that you're back in Olympia full time?
I think we have a great group of new members on both sides of the aisle who are committed to working to solve big problems together. I also think that we know that some of the biggest challenges that we face in the state, like our workforce shortages and our housing shortages, are not confined to urban Washington or rural Washington or the west side of the mountains or the east side of the mountains. Those are challenges that impact the whole state. And I think that the shared experience of unaffordable housing and employers having a hard time filling jobs is, you know, that's a shared experience across the whole state. And that means that we all have an extra degree of commitment to get things done.
But there are still some thorny issues, and one of them is going to be the budget. And you guys still have to craft a budget before the end of the legislative session. Do you expect some back and forth there, or is it going to be a knockdown, drag out fight?
Well, we certainly hope for less than a knockdown, drag out fight. There will be some back and forth for sure. You know, we never fully line up with the budget that the Senate passes right out of the gate. We know that there are going to be some areas in which we make more investments in the Senate and probably vice versa. I have every confidence that we will meet the challenge and come to agreement with our colleagues on the budget by the end of session. You know, I can't speak for whether or not we'll see a bipartisan vote on the budget. That's kind of in the hands of the House Republicans to decide. But I think We're going to have a budget that makes really meaningful improvements in some of the areas of greatest need in our state, things like funding for special education for our kids in K-12 schools and increased investments in getting more people into law enforcement as a career path and shoring up, improving our behavioral health system in the state.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Republicans aren't involved in the budget negotiations as of yet. I mean, the Democratic caucus comes out with their proposal and then the Republicans try to pick holes in it. I mean, that's traditionally how it's gone over the last few sessions in Olympia, hasn't it?
Traditionally, we develop our House Democratic budget proposal, and we take a lot of Republican input into the budget. There are a lot of items that we're going through, even as we speak, that Republican members of the House have suggested as priorities for their district. So I think that there will be a lot of instances in which they have, you know, put their fingerprints on the budget for sure. Whether or not that means that they vote for it in the end, I don't know. It tends to be that we see the greatest amount of bipartisan cooperation on the capital and transportation budgets, but that doesn't mean that there won't be lots of examples of House Republican ideas embedded in the House Democratic operating budget.
Aside from the budget, which is always contentious, there's also a number of other issues that tend to be a little more partisan. In the most recent years, public safety certainly has been an issue that Republicans and Democrats disagree on how to handle. And the issue of police pursuits is one that really got some hackles up on both sides this session, isn't it?
Yeah, we're really wrestling with the issue of police pursuits. There's no question that is one of the tougher issues for us to come to agreement on, even within our caucus. We have very strong feelings on both sides of that issue within the House Democratic caucus. The core issue that we are trying to balance is what protects the public the most, what presents the fewest safety harms to the public. Vehicular pursuits are inherently dangerous. And the reason that we passed the law 2 years ago restricting the circumstances in which police could engage in vehicular pursuits is because of the high rate at which those pursuits end in a bystander being killed. That said, we also know that there are instances where police do need to pursue somebody in order to prevent crimes from taking place. If somebody's suspected of having committed a crime, then we do want police in certain circumstances to be able to prevent another crime from being committed. And so how do you balance those? How do you balance the risk of harm from a dangerous vehicular pursuit relative to the risk of harm from a crime being committed? And that is what we are struggling with. We have members who feel very strongly that we should pass the bill that was sent over by the Senate. We have some members who think that we should wait a few more years to collect some data about the law that's in place today. I expect that whatever resolution we reach this session will leave some people wishing for a different outcome, but we are going to do the best we can to balance those needs.
But the House had a version of the bill that would address police pursuits. That didn't even get a vote.
The House bill did not get voted on. The Senate sent a bill over, and that is the bill that we will be looking at and making a judgment about.
So what happened with the House bill?
The House bill did not have enough support in our caucus to move forward at that time. That was a result of a lot of conversations within our caucus about what we had support for. And, you know, we decided as a team that we weren't ready and that we thought it was likely that we would be seeing that Senate bill, and that in the best interest of all of us to take the Senate bill and have that be what we worked with.
To kind of drill down a little bit, what were you disagreeing on in that House bill, and how is it different than the Senate bill that's coming over?
So the House bill was pretty similar to the Senate bill that was sent over. The key difference is the House bill would have sunsetted it in 2 years. I think we're hoping to see a more robust process at the State Criminal Justice Training Commission to develop a model policy related to vehicular pursuits. That's going to take a couple years, and we thought we could pass that law, which and have that expire in time for us to adopt on a more permanent basis whatever the model policy recommended by the CJTC was. There was also another piece of legislation that we had some support for, but not enough to pass, related to traffic stops by law enforcement. Knowing that traffic stops by law enforcement are one of those kind of high stakes encounters that we often see lead to an escalation of violence, that reducing the frequency of those stops, particularly restricting law enforcement's ability to pull somebody over for a non-moving violation that didn't present a safety risk, could have the effect of really reducing risky or dangerous interactions between law enforcement and the community. I think a lot of members of our caucus felt like if we could do that, then that would make our pathway easier to adopting the vehicular pursuits bill. That didn't quite come together, and we still have the legislation sent over by the Senate, and we have till the end of session to decide if that's the path forward we're going to take.
And then, of course, the issue of the Blake decision and responding to that, the temporary bill is set to expire later this year that was passed in a previous session. Where do things stand on that? Because I know there's some serious divisions between Republicans and Democrats over how to respond.
Yeah, there's some divisions and there's some common ground. I think very, very few Republicans believe, certainly no Democrats and very few Republicans believe that we ought to go back to the state of the law before the Blake decision in which drug possession was a felony. Most of the discussion around this issue today comes down to, should drug possession be made a crime again? And should, if so, should it be a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor? What sort of minimum sentences, if any, should accompany that crime? The bill that the Senate sent over has a 21-day mandatory minimum sentence. And then what sorts of treatment options should people be connected with at various points in the criminal legal process? The Senate passed over a bill that I think leans a little more heavily on the side of criminalization than most of House Democrats are comfortable with. But we know that we need to pass a law this year since our Blake solution from 2021 is expiring. So this is one of those must-do laws. We will be passing a Blake law, a drug possession law this year. I think it will not likely result in felonization, and it will not likely result in decriminalization either. So we're looking at what kind of misdemeanor and what sort of penalties should accompany a conviction for that misdemeanor.
And finally, as we wrap up, what are some of the other bills that you hope you can get some common ground on before the legislative session expires?
Yeah, we've had some very good common ground on a number of pieces of legislation related to fighting the housing shortage by allowing more homes to be built. For example, we passed a very exciting law out of the House of Representatives on a very bipartisan vote that would legalize more types of housing in cities across the state, in areas that currently mandate single-family home construction, to allow property owners more choices about what kinds of homes to build, like duplexes or triplexes. We think that will go a long way towards giving property owners more choices, increasing the value of their property, and increasing the supply of housing and fighting the housing shortage. The Senate sent over a bill related to transit-oriented development, requiring significantly less restrictions on what sorts of homes could be built in areas in proximity to frequent transit. Both of those bills passed out of their respective chambers on a bipartisan vote. There are some good ideas from House Republicans that we have passed out. There was a bill related to making it easier for property owners to split lots and perhaps sell part of their property and allow that to be used to build another home. There is a House Republican bill related to streamlining of permitting and reducing design review requirements related to new housing. So I think housing construction is probably the number one area where we're seeing great progress on bipartisan cooperation. And that has often not been the case in years past. So that's somewhere where I would definitely agree with the minority leader that it's positive to see the kinds of bipartisan votes that we've been seeing on some of the housing bills this year.
All right. State Representative Joe Fitzgibbon, Democratic leader in the State House of Representatives. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure thing. Thank you, Jeff.
Coming up next.
Just how safe are the nation's banks?
When the Northwest Politicast continues after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogola. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen trying to reassure Congress and the public that the American banking system is sound. ABC's Ike Ajachi is joining us now on the Northwest Newsline. And Yellen's remarks this past week came on the heels of the recent bank collapses in California and New York, even after warning signs about the Silicon Valley Bank collapse were missed by regulators. So what's the latest? What exactly is Janet Yellen telling Congress?
That's right. So she testified before the Senate Finance Committee. And this is obviously in the wake of both Silicon Valley Bank in California and Signature Bank in New York essentially failing. And she essentially came there to tell lawmakers that the banking system remains sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them. However, it's important to note that after her opening comments, she faced pretty much a grilling from these lawmakers and on the government's response on whether regulators missed warning signs that the 16th largest bank was in jeopardy. And investors right now are underway at the Department of Justice and the SEC really investigating this matter to understand what's going on. And we've heard so many senators, including Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who essentially said that talking about the United States actions, whether or not they were good enough. And Yellen defended the United States, saying that they were decisive, they were forceful, and they were actions that were used to strengthen the public confidence in our banking system. And she said it was the right thing to do at the time.
Well, this seems very familiar because we saw this back in 2008 with the banking collapse there. Obviously, here in Seattle, we're quite familiar with it, with Washington Mutual failing, the largest bank failure in the United States in some time. What exactly led to the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature Bank and some of the others that are now in trouble?
Well, according to Secretary Yellen, she said that essentially what happened was we saw a runoff, obviously. Some lawmakers pointed to social media or some other things that may have caused this. But we also saw Senator Warren point to the rollback of Dodd-Frank back in 2018 as to a possible reason as to why this happened. But I know Secretary Yellen said that a lot of it were the banks taking too much risk. We saw that Signature Bank was tied into the crypto world. As the interest rates raised, a lot of these banks were taking a lot of risk, and essentially they were taking in a lot of money that really wasn't insured. It wasn't federally backed. And as soon as that sector of the economy saw that downturn, people started to pull their money out of the banks, and these banks, Signature and Silicon Valley Bank, simply just didn't have enough capital in the bank to satisfy all of these requests, which eventually led to these banks failing.
Well, and we all know that banks are protected by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I believe the statute is up to $100,000 for deposits. But we're also hearing that it may go beyond that, and taxpayers would not be on the hook. So where's all this money going to come from?
That's right. So they said that initially that $100,000 was initially ballooned to $250,000 of deposits. And then the federal government said that they would even do more than that. And these aren't taxpayer funds. That's something President Biden said initially when this came out. And that's something Secretary Yellen told lawmakers, that these are actually from the fees paid for by our nation's banks. Essentially, there's a special fund set up, and every single bank in the country pays some kind of fee, and that fee goes into this fund. And all those deposits that are insured and all the ones that are tied to these two banks, they're going to get their money back. They're going to have access to their money from this special fund that was really filled up by our nation's bank, again, by those fees that they've been paying.
So calling this a bailout like Nikki Haley did, who is obviously running for president, is really not an accurate thing. I mean, that's what the FDIC is there for. It's not, as you say, the taxpayers footing the bill.
That's exactly it. And the FDIC is here for this reason and this reason only, to protect the uninsured depositors, obviously insured depositors, to make sure that their money is secure, because the whole idea here is to make sure that the American banking system can be relied upon. That's what a lot of this really runs on. And when you have banks like this starting to fail, it loses confidence within the American people, obviously within the community there, which could trigger other economic factors. That's not something that the United States can risk having, which is why you're seeing that swift movement from the federal government to access that fund to make sure that everyone can still have access to their funds.
So whether it's Silicon Valley Bank in California, Signature Bank in New York, or First Republic Bank, which has been having problems as well, is there concern about other financial institutions that may be in a similar situation and may be in danger of collapsing?
There are. It's not even tied to the United States. We saw that a Swiss bank now is in jeopardy of failing, just like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The Swiss Central Bank has already come out and said that they are willing to supplement that specific bank just in case they need it. So we're seeing a little bit of a ripple effect here domestically and internationally in terms of these banks failing, which is why you're seeing, again, the swift actions from the federal government to make sure that Americans can feel secure about this banking system.
What about Congress? Are they going to be acting any on this? Are they going to be passing any laws to strengthen these regulations that a lot of people say were removed and led to some of this?
That's a possibility. We've already seen a lot of lawmakers, obviously Senator Elizabeth Warren being one of them, calling for a reversal of that 2018 rollback of the Dodd-Frank legislations from 2010. Again, those were put in place from the 2008 financial crisis. And what they essentially were regulations from the nation's largest and obviously middle small banks to make sure that certain things of that nature that started the 2008 financial crisis doesn't happen again. One of the things that was rolled back was essentially a stress test. Banks had to undergo these stress tests to make sure that they can remain financially solvent at the point of any kind of economic downturn. These smaller banks, you know, with $250 million, billion dollars and less, they essentially, after the rollbacks did not have to go through these stress tests. Lawmakers are asking for these kind of regulations to be put back in there, and obviously some more oversight into these bankings to make sure that they're acting in a manner that is safe and secure for their depositors.
All right, ABC's Ikey Jachi, thank you so much for your time and insight.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come,
President Biden issues an ultimatum that could mean the end of TikTok in America.
When the Northwest Politicast returns in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogela. Here's Kim Shepard.
A new ultimatum for TikTok as the Biden administration continues to look at ways of cracking down on the Chinese-owned company. ABC technology reporter Mike Dubusky's on the Northwest Newsline. And first, Biden wanted to ban the app. Now he's saying he'd be happy if the Chinese parent company just sold it off. Why is he taking this new approach?
Right. So, Kim, I think ultimatum is the right word there. So this comes back to an organization called CIFIS, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And they issued this ultimatum to TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, saying, hey, listen, you have to divest from your American operations or we're going to ban you in the United States. This, of course, comes against the backdrop of a lot of scrutiny of TikTok having to do with potentially American user data winding its way back to the Chinese government, or potentially the Chinese government using TikTok to leverage its own messaging. So yeah, TikTok definitely under the microscope right now.
So would selling TikTok to another company address those concerns, though?
TikTok says no. TikTok points to its efforts in Texas. Project Texas is an undertaking that they are instituting with an American company, Oracle. And essentially what that is they're saying, we're going to, you know, centralize our American operations in Texas, have Oracle oversee it. We're going to store all our American user data on American servers that are overseen by this company. And we're going to have that whole operation, Project Texas, overseen by a board of American national security officials. And that's what they say will be enough. I think that the reason that you're seeing so much headway in Congress and at the White House is that maybe they're not going fast enough for the administration and for Congress. So yeah, I think the question mark of exactly, you know, how this is going to get done remains to be seen. But yeah, definitely a couple of question marks here.
Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking about is the fact that the way that the government works in China is obviously very different than here in the U.S. If the Chinese government decided that they wanted information from this company, they could just go get it. They don't have to ask.
Right.
It's required for this company to turn it over to the government. Does it really matter if the server farms are in the U.S.?
Right. And what's more, we here at ABC got our hands on this new cybersecurity report from a company called FeeRoot, which is kind of interesting. It finds that, you know, not only could, you know, American server data not really be relevant to this whole discussion, even if you delete TikTok off your phone, if you institute a ban, that might not actually be enough either, because TikTok and certain apps leave behind little digital footprints that conceivably the Chinese government could use to continue to collect data.
Legislation always is so far behind technology. In this case, this app has been robust, has millions and millions of users, and we're just now talking about legislation to deal with it. How are we going to get to a point where we can be ahead of the curve on this?
That's a huge question. I think that the Congress has made efforts in recent years to be better about technology infrastructure and technology regulation. They've brought in some new blood. Lena Khan over at the FTC is a real professional when it comes to knowing about major platforms, antitrust issues around Facebook and Meta and what have you. But yeah, I think you're right. Legislation lags behind the pace of technology, but that might say less about sort of the pace of our Congress and more about the pace of technology in general. It's just so fast.
You're the glass half full guy. I like that.
I think that there's maybe a tech fatalism out there, which is somewhat justified. But I also think that, you know, we might lose the forest for the trees sometimes when we get into all the doom and gloom portion of it.
True enough. ABC tech reporter Mike Dubusky on the Northwest Newsline.
And that's Northwest News Radio's Kim Shepard.
Coming up next,
trouble at the VA and cracking down on Seattle crime.
When the Northwest Politicast continues after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogela. Well, this week, representatives from Oracle took a grilling from senators over problems at the Veterans Administration. Oracle Cerner provides the VA with an electronic health record system through a $10 billion no-bid government contract. But that system has now been linked to 6 incidents of catastrophic harm, including 4 deaths.
There are problems in the system with suicide flags, with unknown cues, pharmacy issues, and I know that Oracle has begun working on some of those fixes, but we are still talking about the same problems 2 years later.
That's Democratic Senator Patty Murray at a hearing on Wednesday. Now, the spokesman review reports Republicans are equally upset with discussions of even revoking Oracle's government contract. A measure that would have created a hotline to report hate crimes has died in the state legislature. Senate Bill 5427 would have not only created the hotline, but also a fund to compensate victims. That fund and the fact that the hotline would not be tied to law enforcement likely led to its demise.
We support having a state agency provide supports for those who've been the victim of hate crimes. We simply cannot support directing victims of hate crimes to go to a place that can't help them.
That's James McMahon of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, who testified as other during one of the bill's hearings. Now, despite the bill's failure to meet a necessary deadline, the Seattle Times reports the idea is gaining traction and could come back next session. The Seattle City Attorney's Office says it has made significant progress in clearing the backlog of unresolved cases. In a presentation to the City Council, staff to Ann Davison reported the policy of making a filing decision within 5 days of receiving a case has helped. However, they argue that they're still underpaid and understaffed. Criminal Division Chief Nicole Walton Anderson.
In comparison to the city of Auburn or, you know, even the city of Renton, and the fact that, you know, the salaries there, you know, we have lost people to those jurisdictions. And the one of the primary factors is our ability to pay competitive wage.
Now, Ann Davison was elected city attorney largely on a promise to start prosecuting more cases. Her staff says they are fulfilling that promise. And finally this week, the man who set fire to a police building during the Capitol Hill occupied protest is running for Seattle City Council. Isaiah Willoughby pleaded guilty to federal arson charges in 2021 and was sentenced to 2 years in prison with 3 years of supervised release. Now, according to filings with the Public Disclosure Commission, he's running in District 2. That seat is currently occupied by Tammy Morales. And that will do it for this episode of the Northwest Politicast. If you like the show, please leave a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. And for more, be sure to check out our other shows, such as Northwest News This Week, Life Beat with Marina Rockinger, Puget Sound Now with Bill Swartz, and Deeper Dive with Kim Shepard. All are available at nwnewsradio.com or on your favorite podcast app. I'm Jeff Pogela. Thank you for listening, and have a good week.